The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
It must be 19 years ago when I placed a phone call to a person I thought was another person. And I had a huge story, and I had questions for SARS. And I placed a call in great excitement, and with my journalistic bloodlust running in my veins, I strolled through my phone, and I found F for Fani, and I phoned, and I got a voicemail. I said, oh, come on. And I left a message saying, please, you've got to phone me back immediately. I've got something really important to ask you. And then about half an hour later, I get a call back, not from Fani Zulu, the SARS spokesman at the time, but from Fani Titi, who could have just ignored my blunder. He could just have gone, idiot, and put the phone down and ignored it. But he was very kind. And he phoned me back to say, you've got the wrong Fani. And he saved me hours, because I would have sat stressing and fretting as to why Fani Zulu was not returning my calls. And I would have got very cross with Fani Zulu. But you managed to defuse the situation. And that was how the Dave King tax story broke in my kitchen on a Tuesday evening in, I think, 2000, in the year 2000. So thank you for returning that call.
Good to be here, Bruce, and thank you for the invitation. You have a good memory, obviously.
Well, my adrenaline actually flows when I think of that day. It was a very significant day from a story point of view. Fani Titi is the joint chief executive at Investec. He was a non-executive director at Investec, but made a decision to go and take an executive role, which is incredibly unusual for somebody who's had a long and varied career in business and academia and other things to go into executive jobs. Usually, gentlemen of a certain age, ladies of a certain age, choose to go non-executive after the cut and thrust of a tough executive career. Why did you go the other way?
A couple of observations. I retired from full-time work at a fairly early age, having been in my own businesses for quite some time. I have been a business owner for quite a long time. I still own some businesses even today, and retired early and committed my time to assisting Investec as a director, and became chairman of the board of the bank in South Africa, later on chairman of the board of the bank in the UK, and then chairman of the board of the group. And if you know anything about banking, which I'm sure you do, there is nothing like a non-executive chairmanship of a bank. I mean, I spend 4 to 5 days a week.
That's the point, though, isn't it? It literally is a full-time job. And I remember talking to people like Warren Clulow, when he was the chairman of Nedbank, and subsequently also to the new head of the PIC, Royal Khoza. You have offices at banks, and non-executive directors generally keep an arm's-length relationship, but being the chairman of a bank is a hugely complex and responsible job. I mean, you were effectively, although non-executive, serving a full-time job.
Essentially full-time, and that was from around 2008.
Timing was terrible, by the way, because you arrived there as Investec bought Kensington Mortgages, and Stephen Kosseff to this day maintains it was never a subprime bank, but everybody else thought it was, so therefore they treated Investec like it had gone into subprime.
The timing was horrendous. Yeah. Came onto the board in 2003 and took the chairmanship around 2008, as it were, and the last 10, 11 years or so have been difficult, just unwinding the effects of the global financial crisis. Banking is a complex business. It can be a risky business. That is why you need to be close to the activity on a day-to-day basis. That is why, as chairman, one needed to spend as much time as I did at the time, and as every other chairman has to do.
But most chairmen of banks, that's their final job, really, before they go into retirement. You've now come out of retirement into the non-executive chairmanship and said, no, I want executive responsibility. I want to see whether I can make this bank better.
Look, I'm 57 now, so I took the full-time executive job at 56, had retired at about 46, which was way too young. So I had come to a point where I wanted to re-engage. In fact, I was looking to go into the private equity world, which is where I came from, and the opportunity to lead Investec came up. It wasn't really planned. It was a last-minute decision that was taken by the board. And banks are important organizations in any community or economy. So I thought there was a real opportunity to make a difference and a contribution by being part of the leadership of Investec. So I accepted the invitation to serve as chief executive, as unusual as the move was at the time.
It's about as far away as you can get from a farm near Windberg in the Free State, where you were born and where you spent your early years. I mean, tell me about those early years of being a kid on a farm.
You're born in the early 60s on a farm at the height of apartheid oppression.
Yeah.
And at the age of 12, when I was in what is now grade 6, I was supposed to go into the farm labor system permanently.
And you've done your primary, schooling on the farm. You've got what you need. You can count, you can add, you can maybe subtract. That's enough. Good. You've done your duty in Favurdian sort of education system.
Yeah, that's right. So about 3 months before I went into the farm system, my dad had a fallout with his boss at the time, and generally in that area he couldn't really get employed, and it was at the time that African people were being classified in terms of their tribes. So the Southern Sotho's were then being shipped off to the homeland of the Southern Sotho's, which is Kwakwa. That's where I ended up. So literally, that was a change in direction that changed my fate. Otherwise, I would still be on a farm, probably driving a tractor. Those experiences were really important.
I mean, is that story true that as the kid, and I think as a kid on a farm, there are levels of excitement and interest. There's no TV, so you don't have any perspective of the outside world. As a kid on the farm, the coolest job is to be the tractor driver, because it's the least physical of the jobs. I mean, it's an exhausting thing, but you're not having to dig trenches and do that kind of farm labor. That was your aspiration as a kid, was to be the tractor driver.
That would be the height of ambition within that particular system. But my story is an improbable one, a story of possibility and a story of change and a story of opportunity and optimism. So I escaped that particular fate, as it were, but I took from that experience lessons that were imprinted on my mind. Hated poverty because I had lived in poverty, abject poverty. Hated the deprivation of dignity, because that is what the apartheid oppression of the times dealt on, in particular, black people. I also hated a life of insignificance and a mundane life, which I would have had to have prosecuted for the rest of my life. So I looked for significance. I looked for an opportunity to make a difference, an opportunity to win and win big. That's why Investec provides for me and the 10,000 colleagues that we have a platform on which we can build and make a difference.
I mean, Kwakwa is hardly the epicenter of the world. It's hardly, for most people, a place that you would get a big break. How did the big break happen in Kwakwa?
Education became the escape valve for most of us. So as I said, I had 3 months to go into the farm labor system, so escaped that, even though homelands were equally very oppressive. Essentially, they were meant to divide Africans on the basis of tribal affiliation on the one hand, and secondly, they were created to be labor reserves, as it were, but there was at least a system of education that was on the go, not very good in any way, because, as you know, Bantu education was what had been designed for Africans through the apartheid system. But I got an education, was able to get through to matric, then went through to fourth year to study mathematics.
When did you know that you were better than most people at maths? I mean, for Mark Barnes, former chief executive of the post office, he knew at 7, or his teachers knew at 7, that he had a good maths brain. Did somebody identify your maths brain, Young?
Look, within the Bantu education system, there was very little guidance. Literally, you move from one grade to another, and I happened to do well. I had teachers that encouraged me, and some of them led by example in terms of dedication and hard work, and you learn as a kid. from those examples, and you move from one grade to another. And at a point, doors open when you have ability and you partner that ability with commitment, dedication, and application. So as doors opened, got to the University of Fort Hare, ultimately got to Berkeley in the USA. From then on, I think the extent of my success was largely dependent on the application,
yeah.
the desire to dream and to build big.
I mean, you play down getting to Berkeley. I mean, but you do get an MSc, you do get your BSc honors in mathematics at Fort Hare. You then get your MA in mathematics at Berkeley in California, I mean, which is no insignificant achievement. You come back, you do an MBA at WITS. Where do you go? How do you utilize that MBA as a springboard? Because at the time you're doing that MBA, it wasn't as common a qualification as it is today. Not undermining MBAs, they're hard work. But, I mean, fewer people had MBAs back in those days.
Yeah, decided that I wouldn't want to spend the rest of my life teaching mathematics.
Because you did teach, didn't you?
Yeah, at university, yeah. So as valuable as that was, decided that was not what I wanted to do. So I took a detour into business through an MBA. So 1991-92, went out full-time to study, and given one's mathematical background, it was easier to go into the world of finance because one had a natural inclination for finance. So joined at the time RMB in their trading division, supported the trading desk, essentially modeling instruments like, as an example, modeling interest rate curves for the trading desk. So obviously from there got some experience, and over time went into the private equity world, which allowed me to be a business owner, to be an entrepreneur, and to get a sense that one could actually build a business, make a difference. And at a point, Investec became a partner in my own business. And as an entrepreneur, and being a client of Investec in the mid-90s, I was treated with the level of respect as a small business owner, and the dedication of the best resources that I began to appreciate and like the business. And over time, when I went from one business into another, Investec became a partner of mine, and we had lots of fun, built businesses, took over businesses on the stock exchange, listed some businesses in the process. So it's been a long road with Investec from the middle 90s until now.
It's an amazing relationship that successful people build with an Investec. I mean, one of my favorite Stephen Kosseff quotes is, "We break China for the clients." Break China. You know, all-nighters. I mean, the Aspen deal, the creation of Aspen, and sitting, Glenberger and others, sitting until 2-3 in the morning, going through the fine detail, and guys waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning to come back to the discussion table to really get deals done. That culture seems like it persists to this day. I mean, I don't think you'd have it any other way.
I think early on in the building of Investec, the founding generation realized that our culture and values formed an essential signature and a competitive difference for Investec. So that DNA is what makes us successful and different, and we guard it very jealously. So as we go through a transition from the founders into the next generation of management, we are particularly careful to retain that DNA, that culture, and create an environment where our people are motivated, inspired to do more than would be required of them. We create an environment